Avenue is open. Good morning, everyone. We're going to start off with a couple of public hearings on House Bill 2400, 3180, and then do Senate Bill 164. So I will open up a public hearing and work session on House Bill 2400. Mazen.
Good morning, Chair Hess, members of the committee. House Bill 2400 is actually comes to you from the House Committee on Revenue. And this bill is a product of a work that has been going on since the 2016 bill, or House Bill 4146, as probably recall that this bill passed through your committee in the last day of the session. And that bill primarily increased the transient lodging tax. However, it also asked, as part of that increase, asked Legislative Revenue Office to look into ways or study the different things that could be done in order to evaluate and look at different ways of improving and changing, if needs, and recommending those changes to this session. So the State Revenue Office, we put together a work group and came with a number of recommendations out of that work group. And I put in your SMS in the background also a link to your to the full report in case you actually have the burning desire to look at it. It actually is a full report that is on our website. And part of these recommendations that the work group came with is to put the idea of how we allow the Department of Revenue or state agencies to enter into an agreement with other local governments to allow the Department of Revenue to collect and administer their local transient lodging tax. This is for the transient lodging tax levied locally but collected by the Department of Revenue. So this bill allows for that. And it is, as mentioned again, one of the recommendations of the work group.
Great. Thank you. I have Wendy Johnson from the League of Oregon Cities signed up.
Chair Hess, members of the committee, Wendy Johnson here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. The League supports this bill. This bill was a product of the work group that Mazen explained. We thank Representative Nathanson for carrying this bill through on the House side and now over onto the Senate. It's a really simple bill. It just simply allows the Department of Revenue to just provides the authority for the Department of Revenue to collect a local tax if the state and the local government enter into an agreement. So those of you familiar with the marijuana tax situation, it's the same thing. There's agreements now between over 70 jurisdictions. So at the same time you file your state taxes for marijuana, you also file your local taxes, and then the state will send it back to the local government. So it's easier for the local government, and it's easier for the taxpayer to just do one filing. It would be the same for the local lodging tax. The state tax is 1.8% right now. The local ones vary between 2 and 13%. We would like this ability going forward in the future. Right now, the Department of Revenue collects by region, so they couldn't actually do a city tax or a county tax by how their system works. But in the future, we're hoping that this can be done, and this is the first step just to allow the state to collect for us. There's a statute in existing law that lists the various taxes that the state can collect for a local government, but there's no fiscal impact because it says if you have the state collect for the local government, the state has to collect its costs. So it's just more efficient for everybody, and the cost will be recouped. So this is just the first step, and we strongly recommend that you move this bill along. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Senator DeBoer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This allows cities the option. They don't have to.
Chair Haas, Senator DeBoer, that's correct. It's a local option, just like the marijuana one, where it permits an agreement between the state and local government, but doesn't require it.
I'll follow it. Thank you. Ashland uses this in their chamber, so they get an occupancy report as percentage of occupancy, and their suggestion was to make sure that there's an avenue for other cities to get that same report through your collection.
Chair Haas, Senator DeBoer, I'm with the League of Oregon Cities, and we represent all the 241 cities. So the next bill you're going to see is about sharing information between the state and local government so that we can see who the state is collecting from, so that we can make sure we're all collecting from the right people, because sometimes they omit from others. This one is just about authorizing collection by the state if we choose it. The next one is about sharing information, including reports.
Your vote, please.
No.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
In work session, Mr. Chair.
We are in work session.
I move House Bill 2400 to the floor with the due pass.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 2400 to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator DeBoer.
Yes.
Senator Riley.
Aye.
Senator Taylor.
Aye.
Vice Chair Boquist.
Yep.
Chair Haas votes aye. House Bill 2400 goes to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. Senator Boquist, we're down to you.
Chairman.
Senator Boquist will carry. Close work session and hearing and open up a work session and hearing on House Bill 3180.
Now, Mr. Chair, this is the second bill of the recommendations of the work group, and 3180 actually is the bill that allows the sharing of information between the Department of Revenue and local governments in order to improve the ability for local governments to actually get the information on who is paying and who's paying on the state level and not paying on the local level. During the discussions, the idea was that we should be able to share that information and have it available to the different levels of government. However, the Department of Revenue felt that they need a legal justification in the statute to be able to do that, and this bill allows for that to happen.
Wendy Johnson. I should also mention that Bill Perry from the Oregon Restaurant Association was supportive in his comments to the House and was going to sign up to testify today, but he's got another committee he's at, so he was testifying in support.
Great. Chair Haas, members of the committee, again, Wendy Johnson here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. Again, really simple bill. All this bill does is authorize the Department of Revenue to share information with a local government that has a lodging tax. Without the bill, the statutes make all that information confidential. All the parties in the work group agreed that that would make sense for it would help be helpful to local governments as well as the state to share that information to make sure we're collecting lodging taxes from all entities. The only issues were confidentiality, and this bill requires a local government who gets that state information to continue to make it confidential. So it makes that clear. Question of timing, the bill just requires it to be done every quarter rather than just whenever you want. It has to be done quarterly. And then the last one was that we didn't want it to be burdensome either on Department of Revenue or the local government. And so you don't have to create an additional report. It's supposed to be things that you already have in your files or would not be burdensome to the local government or the state to create. So again, trying to keep the fiscal down and just share the information that we have available. So that's all the bill does. Good bill should pass. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
I won't ask anybody whether these two bills could have been combined because it's too late for that now. Mr. Perry, did you want to testify?
I already wrote my notes. He's not here, so I'm not going to change any of this.
Chair Hass, members of the committee, for the record, Bill Perry at the Oregon Restaurant Lodging Association, and I think you sufficiently stated our opinion. Now, we're just here in support because we want to make sure that all the taxes are tried to be collected from every segment of the industry and every jurisdiction evenly, so we think both these bills help. So happy to answer any questions if you'd like.
We're a work session, Mr. Chair.
We are. Thank you, Bill.
Yep. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3180 to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 3180 to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Senator DeBoer?
Yeah, can I make a comment? Thank you, Mr. President, or Mr. Chair. to the Department of Revenue, I know this is quarterly reporting, and I think it's meant to pick up bed and breakfasts and other things that are currently not reporting. But if you can add to your form the occupancy of rooms and the percent occupied during the report, would be of great help. And I think that's actually could be public information for marketing by various chambers of commerce. And that was Ashland's input, which they do a great job of that. So that's it.
Okay. Very good. Further discussion? Seeing none, clerk will call the roll.
Senator DeBoer?
Yes.
Senator Riley?
Aye.
Senator Taylor?
Aye.
Certainly.
Hass votes aye. House Bill 3180 goes to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. Senator Taylor, would you
yes,
carry this bill? Thank you. Close the work session and open up a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 164. Chris Allenack. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 164 is a bill that deals with the preferential pass-through rates from the grand bargain from 2013. You have the amendment in OLIS. It replaces the bill. The bill, as drafted, dealt with allowing amended returns to be filed for tax year 2015. That is pulled out and is replaced with a policy that focuses the rate policy on certain economic sectors. As the committee may recall, the last time you heard this, there were some discussions about different ways that the policy could be focused and potentially be made more effective to at least focus the revenue impact. And so what the dash one does is it limits it to six or seven economic sectors. There is a handout in OLIS called PTE use by sector that shows from preliminary information from a sample from 2015 returns. As you recall, 2015 is the first year that the policy was put in place. So the Department of Revenue was able to go through and draw a sample and organize some other data. And the table on the left there are all of the economic sectors that reported using the preferential tax rate. So I've normalized this to $100 million. The revenue impact is about $100 million per year. And we can see in that the impact ranges from zero for a couple of sectors all the way up to $28 million for professional, scientific, and technical services. And the tables on the right, the Tier 1, Tier 2, and Tier 3, were three different options for focusing the policy. The intent there was to restrict the preferential rates to sectors that were more susceptible to competition from outside the state, basically export sectors. So Tier 1 was ag, mining, and manufacturing. And Tier 2 is what is in the amendment. It focuses it to ag, mining, manufacturing, but also includes wholesale, transportation, warehousing, information, and accommodation and food services. So that's what's in the dash one, and that would limit the impact to about 26% of the existing impact. If the current cost of the policy is $100 million per year, limiting it to these sectors would cost about $26 million a year. And then tier three was just another option. We were just we were putting together different options for the committee to consider in terms of the policy. But the dash one is corresponds to the tier two.
Okay. And as an overview, what we were trying to do here was to I wish Boquist were here, Senator Boquist, because we wanted to create a situation where this helped create jobs and new capital for these kinds of businesses, as opposed to the professional legal services and healthcare sector that didn't need this kind of incentive. And we also had lots of testimony from CPAs that this money was being used after the fact by wealthy professionals. Nothing against wealthy professionals, but that wasn't the intent of the grant bargain. Senator Taylor.
I just have a question. I'm just wondering how that, what the decision-making process of which industries to include.
Is really focused on the investment in industries that were more competition with with businesses outside of the state, the export sector. So manufacturing, ag, that's where we start with the export sector.
Follow-up? Thank you, Chair Hess. I'm just trying to understand, I mean, what information did you have? Because I thought one of the, I thought that we were limited in our information of understanding the benefits of this program. So I'm trying to understand where was that data derived from to know, to think that it would make a difference in order to create more jobs or.
There wasn't, I'm not sure I'm following the particular data source, just from understanding how the different economic sectors work. And so we manufacture here in ag, and those sectors have export most of their product as opposed to them being consumed locally.
Can I be more clear? So what I'm trying to understand is, I mean, I understand that you were just going to basic economic knowledge, but was there some sort of information that was presented that said that for mining or ag that this would, there's something that that was convincing enough to think that those industries should be allowed to continue to receive this benefit?
I believe that's how the discussion started back in 2013, with that, with having a policy that was really intended to enable, well, taking even a step further, it had to do with small businesses and access to capital. And at the time, there were still problems with small, there was still recovery from the Great Recession, and small businesses were having trouble accessing capital through the banks. And the discussion was, well, how could, what could the state do? What policy could be put in place? And so then that led to a policy focused on small businesses and the manufacturing and all of it, and the ag sector and the exports. And then by the time the grand bargain came into fulfillment, it, those had fallen away. So this is kind of getting back to the original discussions.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions, Chris? Okay, let me call some people up.
Let's do that. I listen to people.
Yeah. J.L. Wilson.
Thank you, Chair Hass, and members of the committee. For the record, J.L. Wilson representing the Oregon State Chamber of Commerce. We would probably oppose this particular approach on the basis that a small retail operation is probably no less worthy of the pass-through, lower pass-through rates than a small manufacturer or a wholesaler. We're very supportive of the pass-through tax reductions. We argued strongly for them in the 2013 session, on the basis that from a small business perspective, cash flow means everything. And to be able to have cash flow to capitalize and increase the ability to compete, hire, invest in your companies was a meaningful step for small business. And so we supported that policy. I would also say, if you're intending to limit costs or intending to curb excesses, or what you see as excesses, to me, it's probably a more rational policy to limit, put the limit at $1 million as opposed to the $5 million. We've always felt that you get more relative value at that first million with respect to the rate structure and how it's put together at 7%, then 7.2, and then 7.6 for that first million. That would equate to roughly $25,000 to $30,000 in state tax savings on that first million, which for $1 million company is a very significant sum. The relative value after that first million does start to diminish. But we think in terms of how you apply the policy, it would make more sense to expand the base to include the sole proprietors, to include the mom and pops. There is a provision that you have to have at least one employee at 1,200 hours a week. Would like maybe to lower that threshold so you've got to cast a wider net. But again, I don't think our group would be terribly offended if you lowered the cap below the current $5 million in order to pay for an increase in the ability to cast the net out a little wider. Thank you.
Thank you, JL.
Okay.
Anthony Smith.
Thank you, Chair Haas, members of the committee. For the record, Anthony Smith, Oregon State Director for the National Federation of Independent Business. We represent about 7,000 small businesses here in Oregon, many being the smallest of small businesses. And although 90% of our members have fewer than 25 employees and 70% have fewer than 10 employees, the small businesses we represent in the state account for about 60,000 Oregon jobs. I'm here today to express NFIB's opposition to the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 164, which would restrict the use of the small business pass-through rates to include only the certain industries, the sectors specifically listed in the Dash 1s. And back in February, you may recall that I provided some testimony to this committee on a separate bill that primarily focused on the results of a survey we conducted on the awareness and utilization of these tax rates within our membership. You'll find a summary of that testimony on OLIS, but I just want to draw your attention today to a couple of the major takeaways that were relevant to our discussion today on the Dash 1s. Back in February, we found that 65% of our survey respondents were structured as a partnership, S-Corp, or LLC. 28% of respondents reported using the small business pass-through tax rate in tax year 2015. That was the first year it was available, as Mr. Alanek has already stated. 20% of our survey respondents were aware of the rate structure before filing their 2015 taxes, and 42% of survey respondents were planning to use the rate structure for tax year 2016, and that was a significant increase over the prior year. Our big takeaway was that small businesses were largely unaware of the tax of the change in tax policy at the time, but upon learning more about the tax structure, which types of businesses qualify, and what types of income qualify, small business owners are much more likely to integrate the use of the small business tax rate into their business plans. Now, based on an initial analysis of our member database and the results of the survey and the LRO document that was up before you just moments ago, we estimate that 22 to 41% of our members could be potentially affected by this tax increase. The Dash 1s are based on the Tier 2 slate of industry sectors on the LRO document, and if adopted, specifically that proposal would affect nearly one-third of our members. The industry sectors affected by this change in policy are based on the North American Industry Classification System codes, or NAICS codes. And although the industry descriptions for each category provide a general idea of what kinds of businesses belong to the category, I'd like to just share with you some of the specific types of businesses that would see their taxes increase if they were excluded from utilizing the small business pass-through tax rates in future tax years. The construction industry, for example, is left out of the Dash 1s, accounting for about 12% of our membership. These are the businesses that build our housing and infrastructure. They include home builders, electricians, plumbing and heating contractors, excavators, pavers. A tax increase on this sector at a time when the legislature is considering making targeted investments in housing and transportation seems somewhat contradictory. Higher taxes on construction won't help remedy the lack of supply of affordable housing and could limit the number of projects that Oregonians could expect to see from a transportation funding package. The retail trade industry is also excluded from the Dash Ones, and these businesses include tire and auto stores, furniture stores, flooring, household appliances, computer repair, hardware, lumber, glass, garden centers and nurseries, grocery stores, laundromats, sporting goods stores, bookstores. Oregon consumers pay lower prices when they have a choice about where to shop for the goods that they need, and about 18% of our membership is categorized as retail trade. And since the legislature agreed to the grand bargain in the 2013 special session, small and independent retailers have been hit especially hard by policy changes, recent policy changes like paid sick time, minimum wage increases, and a tax increase on top of this won't help these businesses succeed. It wouldn't be the businesses alone, the business owners alone, who would bear the cost. Customers and workers also feel the effects of limited competition and the availability of jobs. Finance, insurance, real estate, and property management accounts for about 6% of our membership. These are also excluded from the Dash Ones, but they're major line items in the monthly expenses of each and every Oregonian. Small and independent real estate agencies, apartment managers, insurance agencies would see their taxes increase as a result of being excluded from the small business pass-through tax rates. And again, these industries support our housing and transportation needs, and we should be looking for ways to help them succeed, not adding costs. Based on the LRO document's numbers, professional, scientific, and technical services are by far the sector that has benefited the most from these tax rates. But this group of businesses includes far more than just lawyers and CPAs. It includes architecture firms, engineering firms, landscapers, environmental consultants, and veterinarians. The services sector of Oregon's economy provides great paying jobs for the people in our state, exactly the kind of jobs we'd like to see more of. And when entrepreneurs are looking for the right location to start up and grow, the tax code is definitely a factor. I could probably go on and on about the many, many benefits that small and independent businesses provide to our state and their individual communities, aside from the revenue that they generate for the state to spend. But for now, I just ask you to remember the transmission shop in Beaverton with 4 employees, the nursery in McMinnville with 10 employees, the oil change business in Ashland with 7 employees, the concrete company in Hillsborough with 4 employees, and the local independent insurance agent in Milwaukee with 10 employees. They need your help. These are hardworking men and women. Ask you to keep them in mind and reject the Dash Ones and any other proposal that might restrict the use of the small business tax through rates that were agreed to during the 2013 special sessions grand bargain compromise negotiations. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. I guess I have some devil's advocate questions for you.
Sure.
If that's okay. We had lots of testimony from CPAs talking about wealthy cardiologists who looked back only to find that, yes, they did get a tax cut. It wasn't so much that the legislature in 2013 was just trying to cut taxes for the sake of cutting taxes, which is not a terrible thing to do, but that wasn't the point then. It was to cut taxes to spur economic activity. And we've received no evidence that that really happened. And in fact, the legislature made a mistake in fashioning the way it did, for better or worse, because it wasn't our intent to give these giant windfalls to cardiologists or law firms. But that's what happened. And so we need to fix that. So I guess my question is then, what would you do to repair this bill so that it works to what the intent would be of the legislature in 2013?
Chair Haas, thank you for the question. That's a difficult question. You're putting me on the spot here, and I'd say that it's when I'm talking to the small businesses that we represent, they're overwhelmingly the mom and pop Main Street businesses that we think of when we think about small business. So, you know, I don't think I can speak to the law firm or the cardiologist's issue. And if we're seeing evidence, whether that's anecdotal evidence from CPAs who've come in to testify, or actual data that you know our revenue experts have provided, then that's one thing. But when I'm talking to the everyday small business owners of how this rate structure has helped them, it's offsetting real costs that they're incurring. Some of those are just changes in the market. Some of those are policy changes that were made in this building. So I can tell you from the conversations that I'm having one-on-one with the small business owners that we represent, this is something that makes a difference for them, and they want to see it continue. In fact, they've made changes or decisions based on the fact that this is the policy. And so whether it was a mistake or not at the time, or if it wasn't perfect at the time, it's the landscape that small business owners are using in making their decisions. And it's kind of hard to make those decisions based, you know, even a year, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years out when the game can change.
Appreciate that answer. Let me throw you another one. You're on the spot. You signed up.
Yep.
say you went to your mom and pops and said, okay, we have $100 million. What would be the best place to spend that equally, fairly, where we could spur some economic development, where it would be the kind of thing where you would buy a new printing press or hire on a new bookkeeper or whatever? Would you do it this way? Would you do it the way that grand bargain? Or would you say, let's lower property taxes, or let's do this, or let's create a fund, or however you would do it this way?
Chair Haas, what I can tell you is that the taxes that small business pay continues for decades to be a top three issue that small business owners, when we survey our members, are most concerned about. Taxes. Most of the time when we're talking about taxes in Oregon, we're talking about the income tax. So, I couldn't answer individually what each small business owner, if they were to come before you, would say for their individual circumstance. But I can tell you that if we were looking at kind of starting from scratch and going forward on this, I might echo some of the comments that Mr. Wilson said before me, that maybe we would want to look at expanding this to, you know, not just the S-Corps, LLCs, and partnerships, but something that maybe the sole proprietors could take advantage of too. So.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
John Chandler.
I will have some comments. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, here with some concerns about the Dash 1s to Senate Bill 164, since, if I'm reading the LRO handout correct, my clientele doesn't seem to make the cut on any of the three tiers. But I'm not here as part of the traditional legislative effort to shove one's colleagues off the back of the sled, but simply to point out that I appreciate the explanation of the rationale behind the Dash 1s very much. But to point out that my clients, the home construction industry generally, as some of the logic that led to the grand bargain in the first place still applies. And for that matter, some of the logic that Mr. Allenack articulated for the provision of the Dash 1 right now may or may not apply to construction. Specifically, you know, the impact, and I understand the problem you're trying to fix, generally speaking, the impact on the state budget is one piece of the equation. The impact on the businesses, the taxpayers that are helping with that state budget is another. Most construction companies in Oregon, whether it be residential or commercial, are still small businesses, as defined, you know, however you want to define it. We have very few on the residential side. We have very few national companies in Oregon. Most of them are indigenous. Commercial side, probably a few more bigs, but still most of the work being done, whether it be building a road or building a house, is done by small businesses that would be the target, most of which are pass-through entities, the target of the grand bargain in the first place. And lending, which was part of the notions I recall back when we did the grand bargain, was that banking, we were coming out of the recession, the banking industry was still pretty contracted. It was hard to find capital. Leaving money in businesses was part of the thinking. That still applies in construction. I can't speak for other industry segments, but at least for the land acquisition side of the construction process, where you're going out and buying dirt on which you're going to do a project, it is still very, very, very difficult to get bank financing for that, which is a challenge for the industry and part of the reason we're not producing as many houses as we ought to. But even on the operational side, while lending is better, again, because they're small businesses, most of them aren't publicly traded or even privately traded. They're working off of capital they generate and retain. It's still very difficult to get construction loans. Mortgage market's pretty good. The construction side is better. It's still not where it was before the great collapse. anything that takes money out of a business through a taxation process or anything else for that matter, rising prices, you name it, it creates, makes that much more difficult for those businesses to make, keep the capital inside that they can then use for operations. The other thing, to Mr. Allnuck's explanation, there are, I'm not sure that the broad brush, and I'm not being critical, just making a point, though, of import versus or export-driven versus or subject to cross-state competition versus in-state, not all construction companies are insulated that way. There are some companies who have competition outside, particularly in the supply of materials into the operation. I think probably requires a little bit more analysis of these sectors, if construction is any example, than simply that broad brush. All that said, Mr. Chair and members, more than happy to have this conversation. I understand the concern that some, as articulated by you, Mr. Chair, that some of the proposed benefit or thought for expected benefit for the pass-throughs didn't quite materialize. That's a good conversation to have. I can't speak for cardiologists and big law firms, most of whom aren't members of mine. I'm not trying to do anything damaging to them. I'm simply ignorant as to their tax situations. I can tell you that for my clientele, though, this would be a direct and proximate impact and probably not a good one in terms of our ability to keep working at a level that we need to be. With that, I'd be glad to take any questions, and if there's further conversation, I'd appreciate being included.
Yes, I'd want to put you on the spot, too. Devil's advocate question. Let's talk about construction. The housing industry is absolutely on fire right now. You can't get electricians, and prices are going up and up and up. And if this, the intent behind this law was to spur economic activity, how would we do more of that in a housing market, residential construction that you mentioned? How would we possibly do more of that now? I mean, what? Why are we creating incentives for an industry that's on fire, I guess, is the devil's advocate question.
Mr. Chair, that's actually a very good question. While it is a very hot market, we are still underproducing relative to demand on the residential side anyway in last year's numbers, about 8,000 units statewide. So even if we're on fire, the fire should and needs to be bigger. In other committees and other venues this session, we're having a variety of conversations about the housing crisis. In my opinion, and not to blur the lines between committees, the biggest problem facing housing in Oregon is a supply and demand disconnect. And so we could have a lot more people working in construction. It's also obviously multifaceted. I wish it was so simple to say if you just kept the pass-through tax rates where they were, we'd create another 10,000 units. You get into issues of labor shortages, material issues, and so on and so forth. But because it's so complicated, I'm not sure that pulling on one string is the right thing to do either. The keeping the money in these businesses, if they had the money to add more people, they could build more houses. If they had the money, could build the capital to buy more land, they could build more houses. It's not like the industry is at capacity by any stretch. There's a lot of room to grow, and we're seeing the people that are working are working very hard, and as you point out, it's been difficult to find a remodeler or electrician, pick your trade. That said, that doesn't mean that we ought to then say, well, the industry's healthy, now's a good time to see if we can't have them pay more taxes.
Other questions? Senator Riley?
So just my understanding of the reason we did this was because capital was hard to come by, and we were trying to alleviate that situation. And by the way, the grand bargain, I wish we wouldn't call things grand bargain. This one wasn't so grand after all. But
even on our side, we lost all of our purse.
The reason for doing this is somewhat alleviated now, and calling it a tax increase when all we're actually doing is making it, if we do away with this, is making it so that these businesses actually pay their taxes instead of not having to pay them. So it's not a tax increase, it's a removal of a subsidy. So with that in mind, I can't quite see why we continue to do this, frankly.
Thank you, Chair Haas. I guess I would like to see, before we go forward, I guess I would prefer to see some sort of evidence through these other the industries that are left that are on the list we have today that somehow this is making a difference. It's the economy is doing quite well, and so I'm trying to, I just would like to personally have more information as to a little more evidence that it's actually working. Please.
Senator Boquist.
2 points, just a comment to the to Senator Taylor's. I mean, the economy is doing well in certain segments of actually even the sectors that are on this list. And it's doing well in certain geographic locations. It's not doing well in my district, by the way. I mean, we were one of those left behind, and most of portions of rural Oregon have been left behind as we go forward. The second thing I just want to make sure we to reinforce what Senator Riley said is that, I mean, technically speaking, this isn't a tax increase because it's a 16 and 31 vote, because this is actually eliminating, unless LRO has a different answer that has changed from the previous answer, it's a situation, this is elimination of a tax credit or tax benefit. So technically speaking, I'll need to keep in mind that it is a 16 and 31 vote. At least that's what legislative council, some of us, of course, don't believe in the Seattle case, but nonetheless, lawyers say that's what it is, and it is what it is. So, but it is an interesting discussion. I personally, having looked at the dash one, and I have that in a meeting on Wednesday, I mean, I don't think we have the right. I would agree, and I have said from the beginning, we have the wrong mix now, and so far I haven't seen the right mix proposal. There are several of these entities on here that, unfortunately, Legislative Revenue cannot provide us the information, nor can the Department of Revenue, but through the process of elimination, there are organizations right now working to figure out who some of these companies are, because there's so few of them, we can figure that out by deducting reasoning, and of course calling them on the phone, which we're doing right now. So I do think there is a path forward, as Mr. Chandler said, and room for discussion. We just don't quite have the right plan yet. Of course, you can vote over the top of us if you want to.
Senator DeBoer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I need to declare an actual conflict of interest since
One moment, please. No more questions for John Chandler.
Thank you. I heard no punctuation, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Unless we're voting no and issuing notice of minority report, you don't need to declare a conflict yet.
Sorry, go ahead.
I will anyway. when I did my taxes a couple of years ago, I was quite surprised to see a reduction in taxes when we were trying to find revenue at the same time in an election. And I am here to try to help avoid cuts to health care and education. So I have great concern. I don't think we're ready to move this out. I'm not prepared to vote yes for it. And I have calls into all sorts of people and have spent a half hour in the this morning on phone calls trying to figure out, because when I read the bill, I did not understand it. And I read it at least 15 times, and I still didn't understand it. Then I saw the dash one this morning when I got here. So I think we need to have some more discussion so that we don't duplicate a mistake that was made, perhaps, but do it right the first time.
Well, thank you for sharing that. And we just need to fix it. And the options range from just repealing it. That's what's in the governor's budget. To leaving it alone and continue to take testimony from CPAs talking about their wealthy cardiologists, and or we can rearrange this so that the benefit goes to creating economic activity, or we can replace it with something that might be a better fix for small business. Maybe use the same amount of money, but maybe it's a higher exemption on property taxes. Maybe it's something else, but get more value out of the expenditure, I guess. So I think Senator Buckwist took a stab at it with some of these tiers. We're still fine-tuning, and that's where this will go. It's still a work in progress. Senator Buckwist?
I agree.
Mm-hmm. Marcia Kelly and Jody Weiser.
For the record, Jody Weiser with Tax Fairness Oregon. So each of you has employees, and you're probably not organized in such a way in this particular job that you would be able to take advantage of this tax break. But it doesn't make sense that the staff in your office should pay a higher rate of tax than you pay. And that's the policy behind this bill. And it's not wrongheaded. It values one piece of the population over another piece in a way that's not fair. A teacher in a classroom has as much responsibility as somebody who owns a window washing business. And they shouldn't be taxed differently because of the way the world has been set up by the legislature. It's too bad. In 2015, you passed the Credit Enhancement Fund bill. It was an effort to go after, a successful effort to go after helping businesses that wanted help with getting financing. And it's too bad we didn't at the same time end this legislation so that it would never have become something that was in place for people, taxpayers to use, because it does come into that world now of, is it a tax increase or are we undoing what was supposed to be a temporary measure? But I would urge you to end this benefit that was part of a bargain that didn't work well, and instead look at other ways to help those who need funds for their businesses to get access to funds.
Chair Hass and members of the committee, Marcia Kelly, the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition. I provided some written testimony whereby I reminded this committee how many tax breaks, tax credits, tax deferrals have been constructed by the legislature since ballot measure 5 passed. I think small businesses would appreciate trained workforce, people who can do the more technical things that are required nowadays. And one of the things that I see by giving tax breaks and tax credits to industries, in 2013, the mantra was jobs. In 2017, the mantra is housing. By undermining the basic tax structure and not fixing the basic tax structure created by Measure 5, we're going to continue to have this discussion, and we're going to continue to have attempts at fixes to help one group over another with the mantra of either jobs or fixing the economy or access to capital or housing. The more complicated the tax structure is, the more people get left out of finding the goodies, so that they then think that they're having increased taxes rather than actually getting a break. I see no reason to work on this bill unless you're going to do it in connection with the Joint Tax Reform Committee that has not even met yet. So my plea would be to go with the governor's budget and eliminate this entirely and work on real tax reform so that we will not continually have me coming here and saying this is yet another tax break, because I've been doing it since 2001. And pretty soon I'm going to be a real little old lady in tennis shoes in the Capitol, still doing tax breaks unless we get tax reform.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you both. All right, that's our list of witnesses. And that clears out our agenda. We're continuing to work here. Senator Boquist?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to put on the record so that we're all clear. All of our personal staff actually do pay more taxes than we do, because we're paid half as much as our personal staff. And most of the professional staff in the building make three times as much as the legislators, and so they may pay more taxes too, because the legislators, once again, are the lowest paid people in this building. So I just wanted to make sure on the record that, you know, we are much like small businesses. We are taking the risk, and everybody else is making the money. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. We'll go out on that note. Thank you all. We are adjourned.
You have to have
that note. Thank you all. We are adjourned.
You have to have